little song called Wild Side. I think it's an ode to Lou. Kneel down, ye sinners. Streetwise religion. Greed's been crowned the new king. Hollywood dream teens. Yesterday's trash queens. Save the blessings for the final ring. Amen. On the wild side. I carry my crucifix under my death list. Forward my mail to me in hell. Liars and the martyrs lost faith in the Father. Long lost in the wishing well. Wild side. Fallen angels so fast to kill. Thy kingdom come on the wild side. Our Father who ain't in heaven. Be thy name on the wild side. Holy Mary, Mother may I. Pray for us on the wild side. Name dropping no names, glamorized cocaine, puppets of strings of gold. East LA at midnight, Papa won't be home tonight. Found dead with his best friend's wife on the wild side. Fatal strikes, we lie on the wild side. No escape, murder, rape, doing time on the wild side. A baby cries, a cop dies, a day's pay on the wild side. Tragic life on the wild side. Kicking ass on the wild side. Ah, lyrics to kill your career by. Chew on that, MTV. January 31st, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:30 a.m. I weigh 164 pounds, 40 pounds less than a year ago. Last night I went to Vanity's, and when I left this morning, I stole one of her leather jackets. I'm so fucking thin, I can wear her clothes, and some of them are actually baggy. Doc came around today while Jason was here and kicked him out of the house. Fucking asshole. He may be our manager, but he can't tell me what to do in my house, even if what I want to do is kill myself.
Doc McGee. Nicky looked fucking awful when he became a junkie. He sank into himself, lost all his weight, and just hung around his heroin den house looking horrible. I went around there once when his dealer was there, and I told this pasty piece of shit, if you ever see Nicky Six again, or I hear you've brought him even one bit of heroin, I will have you killed. I would have done it too. Nicky was all junked out and the dealer guy was just fucking vermin.
February 1987. When I'm losing my mind, the only thing that can save me is heroin. February 2nd. 1987, Van Nuys, 1 a.m. When I'm losing my mind, the only thing that can save me is heroin. I love the ritual of heroin, the smell, the way it looks, and when it goes into the needle. I love the way it feels when it goes into my skin. I love watching the blood register and mix with the beautiful yellowish-brown liquid. I love that moment just before I push. Then, I'm under that warm blanket once again, and I'm perfectly content to live there for the rest of my life. Thank God for heroin. It never lets me down. I'm off the methadone. It didn't work. 9:30 p.m. Daytime in the studio for a rock band is torture. When you're a creature of the night, daytime is not your best creative time. But that's when our producer wants to work. Tom Werman can be such a whiny little fucker. I have no idea why he's producing our album. We're doing all the work. He's just on the phone most of the time or sending out for food. He hasn't come up with one idea to better our music. I used to like this guy, but now I realize he's just a money-grubbing cheeseball. This is his last album with us. He can produce Poison or some other bullshit. I have to do all the work with Vince on the vocals, and it's hard being a mess and trying to organize vocals. I always do, since I write the lyrics, but Werman could at least help. Vince is just always trying to hurry through the vocals, and it drives me nuts. I know I drive him crazy, but he would just do a half-assed job if it wasn't for me bird-dogging him. I'm sure he hates me. That makes two of us.
Vince Neil. When Nicky was coming into the studio fucked up, I could only tell he was strung out because he wasn't saying anything. Nicky likes to talk. If he wasn't talking, it meant he was fucked up. And can I tell you something? I liked him like that. I was happy when he was quiet at the girls' sessions. I've never had any interest in sitting around a studio, watching Nicky play bass, or Mick play guitar, but Nicky has always liked to be there when I record my vocals. He's always had to give his opinion or criticize me, and I've always told him, dude, shut the fuck up. We've gotten a few fights over that. Nicky was spending a lot of time shooting up in the bathroom during the girls' sessions, and that suited me fine. It was the perfect time for me to record my vocals. Tom Zutaut. I was Motley Crue's A&R man at Elektra Records, and Nicky Six used to go on and on about how he was the guy who was going to set rock and roll on fire and take over first Sunset Strip and then the rest of the world. I thought to myself, yeah, he's absolutely right. The kids are bored with New Wave, and this glam rock Kiss meets the New York Dolls version of Nicky Six's is going to change popular music. The second time I ever met Nicky, he described to me the almost cartoon-like character attributes of each member of Motley Crue, why they were there, the part each of them had to play within the crew, and how with his songs they would revive rock and roll and kill New Wave. At that point, I was convinced that Nicky was one of the smartest guys I ever met. The remarkable thing is that he had his vision of Motley Crue laid out in his head from day one.
February 4th, 1987. Van Nuys, 10 p.m. There's some good songs coming from this album. I'm really proud of Wildside. But other times, I'm just recycling old Aerosmith riffs or repeating myself. I know I should be trying harder, but I can't be bothered. I never thought I'd say those words.
Doug Thaler. Nicky was normally a talented and prolific songwriter, but he just couldn't write enough good songs for Girls, Girls, Girls. You want the truth? Tom Werman made that record. We even had to include a live track, Jailhouse Rock, on the album. Nicky wrote one song in a key that Vince couldn't even sing, and some of his lyrics were absolute dreck. One day he came in wasted, and he'd just written a song called Hollywood Nights that was just so bad. Really, really horrible.
Lost lyric. Candy-coated Holocaust buried in the past, swallowed all these lies and shitted out your ass. Babies born with switchblades, dumping body in the Everglades. California high tide, needles on a fishing line, backwashed and belly up, dancing on a landmine. February 6, 1987, Van Nuys, 3:15 a.m. It's pouring rain outside. I'm alone again, sitting here with this one candle, my pen in hand, trying not to reach for my dope. I can't stop. I'm so strung out and I can't get off. I don't think I'll ever be off drugs. I think this is my purpose in life. I'm going to be that guy who had it all and lost it all because he couldn't stop. Or just another dead rock star. The rain is making a beautiful rhythm on the roof. It's hypnotizing. Sitting here reminds me of when I was a kid, lying in bed, listening to the rain, wondering where my mom was or if she was even coming home. I feel the sorrow still. It stings. Everybody thinks I'm tough as nails. If they only knew.
Doc McGee. Nicky Six was a pretty fucking angry guy in 1987. He was very nice and polite and intelligent, but he had a really dark side to him. I think it all comes down to the way his family life was before he came to LA and a lot of the things that happened to him as a child. Let's just say that he had a pretty disturbing start to his life. There are some things that I'm just not able to tell you about.
February 7th, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:40 a.m. I can't feel my soul. This darkness has become my only friend. My new addiction is drinking tons of water right before I shoot coke and puking it up all in the jacuzzi as my head explodes into the stratosphere. Why? Why not? I'm engaged in a dance of death in this house. Random lyric, Hooligan's Holiday. Drop dead beauties, stomping up a storm, lines of hell on our face, bruised bad apples, crawling through the night, busted loose and run away. February 8, 1987, Van Nuys, 2 a.m. Bob Timmons came down to rehearsal today. I have no idea who sent him down. He asked me straight out if I was using. Of course I denied it. Said I'd just been partying hard, doing too much blow and drinking, but I could easily stop if I wanted to. I don't know if Bob believed me. I mean, he didn't look like he did, but I'm not going to let him put me in rehab again. I'd kill him first, or kill myself. Bob Timmons and Doc McGee put me and Nicole in rehab in the summer of 1986. I hated it, and it was a disaster. The counselors kept talking to me about God. In those days, I agreed with my grandfather. Who needs God when you got a Chevy pickup truck and a 12-gauge shotgun? I lasted 3 days. One nurse kept talking to me about God until I stood up and yelled, "Fuck God and fuck you." The nurse told me to sit back down, so I spat in her face, jumped out the window, and took off walking home. It was only a few blocks from my house. Bob followed me in his car until we agreed that he wouldn't take me back to rehab. He took me to my house, and I showed Bob my ritual room, my bedroom closet. It was covered in dirty black marks from all the spoons, and Bob and I spent hours cleaning the room. We went through it, finding all the bundles of coke, pills, booze, syringes, and disposed of it all. The only thing I didn't get rid of was my guns. I promised Bob I can do this on my own. I don't need rehab. The second Bob left, I picked up the phone, Jason delivered the cocaine and the junk an hour later. Then Bob came back, I wouldn't let him in. I was lying on the floor in the hall, talking to him through the crack under the front door, with my .357 cocked and loaded. He was asking me to go back to rehab, and I was saying I'd rather die than go back there. I said I'd shoot myself if he tried to come in. Except when I came down from the cocaine, Bob had never come back at all. It had just been me and my demons yet again. Nicole stayed in rehab for a few weeks and got clean. She and I were inseparable drug buddies, never leaving each other's side. But as soon as she came out clean, we didn't have anything to say to each other. We didn't even know each other. We had met via shared love of narcotics, and as soon as that was gone, we had nothing. So that was the end of that, for now.
Bob Timmons. When Nicky walked out of rehab in 86, the rehab center phoned me. I happened to be in the area and saw Nicky walking down the street. I pulled my car over and asked him what was up. He just said, "Fuck you." So I drove real slow alongside him as he walked along and glared at me. Eventually, when I promised I wouldn't take him back to the center, he got in my car and I drove him home. When we got there, we cleared out his closet of all of his drug paraphernalia. It was like an exorcism, getting rid of all the bad memories that were in his living space. Did I know that Nicky called a dealer as soon as I'd left? No. Does it surprise me? No.
Tim Lutzi. I remember once cleaning Nicky's house out of booze, bent spoons, and all the needles that were lying in every closet and on every cabinet shelf. I thought I had found all of his drugs and paraphernalia, but it turned out later that he had a hidden stash in the brass balls on top of the bedposts. He came home, unscrewed one of them, and shot up. There I was, busting my balls, cleaning his house out, and I didn't check the balls.
February 10th, 1987, Van Nuys, 4 a.m. Today was mostly a wasted day in the sense that I didn't achieve anything other than laying around on the sofa talking on the phone all day. But today felt good. It felt like my skin wasn't crawling, my insides weren't on the outside, and also felt sort of flat, non-committed to life. I wish I knew what this hole in my soul is all about, because let's be honest, this isn't about now, it's about then. No father, no mother, no memories of a childhood other than being shuffled around the country. Donna and Tom loved me, and I loved them, but something is blazingly apparent. My mother and father had other things to do than raise me, other things that interested them more. Maybe that's why I've turned out the way I have, where my rage comes from, but I don't know how to make it go away. My father left when I was very young. His name was Frank Ferrana, and so was mine until I changed it in my teens because I wanted that bastard totally out of my life. My mother is named Deanna, and I believe she loved me when I fit into her plans, but when I was a kid, she was usually nowhere to be found. When I was young, I felt every time she met a new man, she'd ship me off to live with her parents, Nona and Tom, in Idaho because I was in the way. This was an introduction to abandonment that could only lead to bad things. The whole thing left me feeling unlovable and festered into the sores of anger, rebellion, and discontent. It caused a lot of the angst that I took into Motley Crue and my life.
Deanna Richards. Nikki's father was a very selfish person. The world revolved around him and nothing else. I left him when Nikki was 10 months old, and Nikki and I went to live with my mother, Nona, and her second husband, Tom. I didn't know what else to do. I was 19 when I had Nikki, and I had no parenting skills, and Frank was binging on drinking, drugging, and going out with other women. He never had any time for Nikki at all. We never heard from Frank for 5 years until one day he turned up out of the blue at Lake Tahoe, where Nikki and I were living, and said he wanted to see Nikki. I asked him why, and he said, "I'm planning on getting married again, and the woman I'm marrying can't have kids, so I want to see what kind of kid he is." He had decided to check out his son after 5 years to see if he was worth taking. Nikki and I were so close when he was a little child. It was so wonderful. When he was about 2 or 3, every time I walked into a room, he would throw his arms up and shout, "Darling," and run to me. I can still remember holding him up against my chest and feeling his heartbeat and just how precious it was to hold him. My relationship with my own mother, Nona, was difficult. She was a very cold woman. The first time she ever put her arms around me, I was 37 years old. As a child, I could do nothing right, and she just always asked why I couldn't be more like my older sisters. Later, she was just horribly judgmental. I was a little wild, and I might sleep with a man without being married to him, and oh my God, it was the worst thing in the world to my mother. I was just a tramp to her. Nona had married Tom when I was 16, and I was really angry with her for doing it. I felt like she had never shown me any love, and yet she had all the time in the world to give to Tom. I thought it was really unfair. Nona and Tom were always telling me how to raise Nikki, what to say to him, what I should be doing. They were always asking me to send Nikki to stay with them for a week or a weekend at a time, and I used to do so. But I would never have imagined that they would do what they did to me. You never imagine your own family will plot against you to steal your son.
Tom Reese. Nikki's dad, Frank, was just a typical California hustler. I liked the guy, but then he went off the deep end into the drug thing. When he was a boy, Nikki would stay with me and Nona in Idaho a lot. Might be for a few days, or sometimes it was as long as a year at a time. Nikki was real close to Nona. He was the son she never had, and she doted on him. Nikki's mother, Deanna, was wild. She was always going off with guys. She'd meet some guy and just go off with him and leave Nikki. She'd go off with Italian guys, truck drivers, you name it. Nikki would come to stay with us for a while, then Deanna would come back and take him. Then we'd have to go get him again, then she would talk him into coming to her, then she'd throw him out and we'd fetch him again. That was just the way it went. Deanna was crazy as a kid. Even when she was 8 years old, she would go to a show and her sisters wouldn't sit with her because she would end up necking with some kid. Everything came easy to her. Her sisters had to work hard to do well at school, but Deanna was so smart. Better than everybody else. She would pick up a musical instrument, and in no time she would be playing it. Deanna was the smartest of the girls, but she didn't have a brain in her head. Nona would bend over backwards for her. What she did for the other girls, she did for Deanna, but you couldn't do anything for her. You would say, "Good morning, Deanna," and she would fly off the handle at you. She'd sneak and steal and lie. We had a little restaurant, and she used to wait tables for a while, but we had to stop her because she was stealing too much. We sent her to a psychiatrist, but she was cleverer than him. You had to let Deanna do what Deanna was going to do, because you couldn't do nothing else.
Random lost lyric. The hatred I've learned for myself will fester in the wounds on your soul. February 11th, 1987, Van Nuys, 6 p.m. Some guy just came to the door preaching about the Lord, so I told him I worshiped the devil to get rid of him. I've got to give it to the guy. He didn't skip a beat. Just kept on trying to save my soul. Then the phone rang and I told him I'd be right back, but I forgot he was there. I guess the dude finally took the hint and split, but he did leave me this nice little pamphlet. I think I'll save it and give it to Vanity. I'm meeting Ricky up at the cat house tonight. Better order a car to drive me there. I need to order a few things. I'm running low. I've had no toilet paper for a week, and I'm on my 8th day without a shower. I am so into writing all this down. Sometimes when something's happening, all I can think about is getting into this journal and writing. It's crazy. February 12th, 1987, Van Nuys, 5:10 a.m. Tonight started off with a bang. I scored some old school loads from this black cat who sells porno out of his house in Van Nuys. He also had some China White. We headed out to the cat house. It was very cool. They only played glam rock from the early 70s. Hearing T-Rex blasting at that volume really puts a smile on my face. I remember seeing T-Rex at the Paramount Theater in Seattle as a kid right before Bolan died. Anyway, fuck, what a meat market that place is. Girls galore and every sweet one ready for anything. So be it. Out to the limo and off with the clothes, a few lines up the nose, and voila, rock and roll cliche 101. Back into the club, back out to the car with a different chick, and on and on. So how did it change? How did I end up crouched behind my bed with my gun? The hell's wrong with me? I'm glad nobody from the club came back here with me. Who knows what might have happened? Cocaine sucks, but I love it. I need to have a couple drinks and try to sleep. I'm supposed to meet the decorator tomorrow to look at some gothic English desk. I hope I'm not too hungover again. Blah, blah, blah.
Tom Zutaut. I first realized Nicky had gone beyond the point of hard partying one night in 1983 when Roy Thomas Baker threw a big party for Motley Crue at his house after remixing Shout at the Devil. Nicky went for it all night. Too much sex, a huge pile of blow, and gallons of hard liquor, not to mention whatever pills he might have ingested out of his own pocket. At one point, I mentioned to Roy that it would be a bad idea for anybody to leave, as it was clear that no one was in any condition to drive. Roy pushed a button, and I heard the sounds of a prison lockdown. Doors closing, gates swinging shut, and deadbolts clanging. RTB explained that he never wanted any of his invited guests to get hurt, so when everyone was too high to navigate home safely, he simply locked them in and insisted they spend the night and stay for breakfast. Nicky decided he was going home and must have come to me a dozen times asking me where the door was. Eventually, he would find a door, but with the house in lockdown mode and Nicky barely conscious, there was no way he was getting out, or so I thought. The next day, we sat down for breakfast and only one guest was missing, Nicky Six. We found his car a few blocks away, wrapped around a tree, and eventually we found him at his apartment with his arm in a sling, a survivor who somehow had definitely beaten the odds, given the condition he was in that night. No one knows to this day how he managed to get out of Roy's house that night, much less find his car keys and drive home. It made me realize that Nicky was willing to cross the line and put his life in danger with excessive drug and alcohol abuse. But that said, he also seemed to be indestructible.
Ragtime, fast lane, another overdose. You know James Dean wasn't playing the role. I said, hey, you, what you gonna do when time runs out on you? 4 p.m. Fuck, just woke up. What's my excuse today? Maybe I have the flu again. February 13th, 1987, Van Nuys, 5 p.m. Been listening to music and playing guitar all day. Heroes, why do we look up to them? Is it their music or their lifestyle? For me, it's both. I'm 29 years old. They say you grow out of loving rock and roll, but it's such a huge part of me. It feels like music raised me, adopted me, and saved my life. Top 10 this week, Aerosmith, New York Dolls, Mott the Hoople, Sex Pistols, Sweet Stooges, Queen, Rolling Stones, Ramones, and of course, T-Rex. February 14th, 1987, Van Nuys, 6:20 p.m. I've decided I should do something for Valentine's Day to mark the anniversary of the day that I died. I think I'll call Vanity. I'd overdosed in London exactly a year earlier, Valentine's Day, 1986. We had played Hammersmith Odeon, and the second we left the stage, I caught a taxi with Andy McCoy from Hanoi Rocks. He took me to a heroin apartment in a real shabby neighborhood. I was drunk, and I remember I was very impressed that the dealer had clean needles. When he offered to shoot up for me, I let him. Big mistake. The problem with street drugs is you never really know exactly how potent they are from dealer to dealer. So I OD'd on the spot. My lips turned purple. I was gone. Now, the story I heard was that the dealer grabbed his baseball bat and tried to beat the fucking life into me. He couldn't, so he flung me over his shoulder to dump me in the trash, because nobody wants a dead rock star laying around. Then I came to. I guess I had yet another dark secret to never tell anybody. Let me tell you, I felt like shit. When you die, every single muscle in your body, it hurts. Your body is closed down because it thinks it's done, and when it gets rebooted, every inch of you hurts. Plus, I'd had the shit beaten out of me with a baseball bat. The second show at the Hammersmith Odeon wasn't the happiest gig I've ever played.
Tim Lutzy. Nicky started taking heroin with Hanoi Rocks in Britain on the Shout of the Devil tour. Hanoi just weren't looking right. Their eyes were off, but Nicky was a most willing participant. He was always destined to get hooked on heroin. If it hadn't been with the dudes from Hanoi Rocks, it would have been someone else.
February 15th, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:15 p.m. What the fuck was that about? Even by Vanity's standards, last night was insane. When I called her, she didn't want to come over and invited me to her place instead. I soon found out why when I got there. She'd been smoking coke for hours and looked pretty fucked, so I thought I'd join in. Vanity started doing her crazy art shit, and we ended up doing bass all night. Then, when it got light, she told me she felt hungry. That seemed weird because nobody gets hungry on coke, but I said okay, and I drove out to get bacon and eggs and orange juice. Then when I got back 10 minutes later, the guards wouldn't let me in the gate to her complex. They said she wasn't there. I was telling them, fuck you, when two black guys drove out in a Cadillac. That's weird. There's no black people in there besides Vanity. She drove out 10 minutes later. I chased her down in my car and asked who the black dudes were. She said they were just friends. Weird night. She always finds a new way to mess with my head. I found out later from her sister that the two guys were dealers delivering coke. One more cute thing about Vanity back then. Her car license plate, it said ho, ho, ho. When Prince had finished with her, he told her, you ain't nothing but a ho, ho, ho. And she liked that because she had a thing for Santa Claus. That sort of made sense in Vanity Land.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. I was a glutton for punishment with Nicky and also the punisher punishing. It wasn't easy being high all the time and relating to another human being. He could have related better with a pet rock. I won't pretend that I was always there. If our relationship had been examined by a professional at the time, his diagnosis might have read, intensive care is much needed for this mad, neurotic, paranoid, psychotic, disturbing relationship with egos at large coming through the door. I believe there's a whole facade to the facade of being an idol, don't you think? We take on the mysterious role of its origin. Everybody else traveled the same road, so we might as well follow the drugs, the sex, trash the hotel, the crazy parties, grow your hair longer, look the part, wear the makeup, and act crazy until it kills you. The rest is simple. Boy meets girl. Girl gets yucky. Both get woozy and call it love. Oh, yes, sick.
Lost poetry. Her love is like a swimming pool. Winter comes and it's no use to you. Her love is like a suicide. Lose your faith and it takes your life. Her love is like a merry-go-round, spins you in circles, and then knocks you down. Her love is like cheap alcohol. Morning comes, and you don't remember at all. Her love is like a Cheshire cat, at first so friendly, but at you it laughs. Her love is like a passionate kiss, at first so sweet that it takes your breath. Her love is like the stars above. Your guiding light always leaves you lost. Her love is like Jesus Christ. No matter how much faith, you still die on the cross. February 17th, 1987, Van Nuys, 1 a.m. Today I didn't drink, mostly because I was pissing blood again. It'll pass. It always does, right? I think I've done pretty good today. I'm reading a great book called Junkie by William Burroughs. I never really cared for Naked Lunch. February 18th, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:30 a.m. Slash came over today. We were playing guitars and having a few drinks, watching MTV. I went for a piss. When I came back, Slash was looking at me funny. He asked me why I still have my Christmas tree up with unopened presents under it. That's a good question.
Slash, my first memory of Nicky was seeing him play with his band London at the Starwood. I was about 14 at the time, and he was just this charismatic glam punk bass player who made a real big impression on me. Then I remember him coming to my high school and giving out flyers to a Motley Crue show at the Whiskey A Go-Go to all the hot chicks. Motley Crue was America's Sex Pistols. On a musical level, they had some catchy songs and cool lyrics, but they were all about the attitude and the image. They were the only band coming out of the LA scene, apart from maybe Van Halen, who had any sincerity and took what they were doing seriously. And it was all down to Nicky. He just had this focus, a real sense of direction. I hung out with Nicky at his house a little in 86, and I found a sickening allure in his lifestyle. My worst junkie years were behind me by then, but I was drinking like fuck. I'd start the day with a Jack and coffee. My junkie years were dirty and sordid, but Nicky seemed to me to have found a cool, glamorous way to be a junkie. Guns N' Roses still hadn't taken off then, so I was still a street kid. But let me be honest, if I'd had Nicky's money, I would have been living exactly the same way that he was.
February 19th, 1987, Van Nuys, 6:15 p.m. Just got back from antique shopping, bought some old books. Tonight I'm going to read one called 5 Years Dead. Seems kind of fitting. What is it about antiques that intrigue me? There's a feeling of history, a story not so plain to see that seeps from the wood. It somehow makes me feel comfortable. I almost bought an old coffin today, but I couldn't think where to keep it in my house. The house is shrinking. Midnight. I lost so much weight, none of my clothes fit anymore. February 20th, 1987. Van Nuys, 4 a.m. So I started writing a song called 5 Years Dead. I guess it's just another attempt at capturing what Aerosmith did on their first album. But what a great record. It brings back all the best and the worst memories from Seattle. How I survived those days, I just don't know.
Ross Halfen. That was how Nicky got his song titles. He told me he used to get old books and steal their titles. 5 Years Dead was only one example. There were plenty more.
5 Years Dead. Uptown, downtown, haven't seen your face around. Paper said you shot a man, trigger-happy punk down in Chinatown. February 21st, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:45 a.m. I wonder what my sister's doing right now. I wonder if she hates me for hating Mom. I wonder a lot of things. One, does my dad know who I am? Two, does my band hate me and want to find another bass player? Three, how's Lisa? Four, will I ever have a family? Five, what would happen if someone found these diaries? Lisa was the sister I never knew. After she was born, a year after me, all I remember was that my sister had vanished. I never knew where she had gone until I was older. Lisa's whereabouts intrigued and troubled me all my life, but it wasn't until the late 90s that I discovered she was living in a sanatorium. I knew she had had Down syndrome and other major health issues, but to be honest, it was all a huge mystery to me. In a heart-to-heart conversation with my mom, I discovered where Lisa was just before I toured the new tattoo album. When I called the people who had cared for her for all these years, they told me they had remembered me from when I was a boy. I said I was told that we couldn't see her because it would upset her and it was better never to visit. They told me, no, that's not true. We always wondered why you never came to visit. I said I was a musician, and they told me Lisa's only pleasure in life was listening to the radio. She was living in San Jose, where we had played many concerts. My heart sank and my anger soared. Oh God, I thought, more misinformation, and I arranged to visit her as soon as the tour had finished and vowed to do something to help change her life. By the time the dates ended, she had died, and all I could do was build an angel statue with wings in her memory. It's one of my life's huge regrets that I never knew her. I used to blame my mother, but now I know I had the power to force my way into Lisa's life. I'll never forget holding her little hand in the casket and looking down at her sweet face. We had the same eyebrows. We never had a chance to be together. I cried harder than I've ever cried in my life.
Deanna Richards. When Lisa was born, doctors knew very little about mongoloidism. All they knew was that mongoloid children had two genes instead of one. Lisa was a very extreme case of Down syndrome. The majority of Down syndrome kids reach a mental age of anywhere from 3 to 10 years old. Lisa never reached that. She never walked, couldn't feed herself, nothing. She literally had the mind of a newborn baby all her life. When Lisa was born, the doctors told me, "Don't take her home. She will never be all right. She will never live." But when she was 2 months old, I went to the hospital and I took her out. The doctor said, "You can't do this. She's going to die." And I said, "Well, then she's going to die in my arms at home." I took her home and I tried to take care of her, but her father and I broke up and I couldn't afford the constant care of the doctors and the nurses and everything. I became quite ill myself trying to look after her, and Nikki was getting totally ignored. I managed to find a little private hospital just outside Scottsdale, California, that took care of Down syndrome sufferers. They wanted Lisa there, but to get her cared for, I had to give up my legal right to her and make her a ward at the state of California. I signed away my daughter, and the people who ran the hospital told me to walk away and never look back. I asked why, and they said, "Because it will only rip you apart. Lisa doesn't know you. She will never be anything but what she is today, and you will just tear your life apart." I wouldn't listen, and I made a lot of financial sacrifices to go see her every week, but it got to a point where Nikki, who was 3, was feeling so neglected that he would just sit on the floor and rock. And I had to make a choice. It was Lisa or him. So I stopped going to see Lisa and started spending more time with Nikki. Things with Nikki started improving then, for a little while at least. Nikki should not feel guilty about any of that. He never had any control over what happened to her, nor did I. There would have been no point in him going to see her because she wouldn't have known who he was. And when strangers came in, she got upset. For years, I thought I had done something terribly wrong to deserve all that happened to Lisa. Then, eventually, I realized that she was a special gift from God. Cece Comer. Whenever Mom talked about Lisa, she was always soft-spoken and heartbroken, and you could tell it was excruciatingly painful. She never denied us information, but she was hesitant about visits. I remember asking several times if we could go see Lisa, and it made Mom cry. She stopped visiting because it would make Lisa go into fits and be upset and withdrawn for days, and Mom was under the impression that complete strangers would have the same effect, or worse.
8:45 a.m. I've been thinking for a while, why do I always buy such pissy amounts of dope? I just use it all right away, Then I have to wait for Jason to come around to see his stupid face every day. Why don't I buy in bulk and just see him every week? I'm waiting for Jason now. He's coming over with 1 ounce of Persian and a 2 ounce bag of blow. I should have done this a long fucking time ago. February 22nd, 1987, Van Nuys, 5:30 a.m. Tonight may have been the worst of my life, which is really saying something. After Jason left, I started shooting up, and the insanity kicked in right away. I don't remember going into my closet, but I was there, freaking out, knowing the cops outside had followed Jason here and were outside the house, coming in. I was banging so much that I knew I had to puke. I was too scared to get to the toilet, so I just puked in my closet. I only made it to the toilet when the cops were at the door. I flushed the entire stash. Then I came down. Nobody had been here. Nothing happened. I'm truly insane. I had to call Jason to get more gear. He couldn't believe I'd flushed it, nor can I. What an asshole. This was a spasmodic occurrence. I would decide to buy drugs in bulk, then I would invariably binge as soon as I got them, freak out, and flush them away. Once I did it twice in one night, and Jason said he had no more supply left. Then he asked me, "What the fuck is wrong with you, flushing drugs anyway?" I guess you know you're in a bad way when your antics are exhausting the patience of a junkie drug dealer. Lost lyric. My nose is all chapped, got a knife in my back, got a nasty reputation, and I'm getting too thin. Now my friends all laugh how I fell for the crack. Hooray for addiction. What a mess I'm in. February 24th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:30 p.m. I felt so hungover and strung out in rehearsal, but 5 years dead sounds badass and the album is going to turn out okay. What does it say about me that I can write songs when I feel like I'm dying? I wonder what I would be writing if I were straight.
Tom Zutaut. Nicky was a pretty intense, driven individual. So when he first started dabbling, he seemed to be kicking back a little and finally able to enjoy the fruits of his hard work to get Motley Crue to the top. We didn't realize it was heroin at first. He just seemed a little dreamy and nodded off on a few phone calls. When I realized it was junk, I voiced my concern to Nicky, and he assured me he was stopping and had it under control. When it didn't stop, I mentioned it to the band's management, who told me they were dealing with it. Once I realized exactly how big his problem was, I was very worried about him. It seemed like the train was moving so fast and drawing in so much cash that nobody wanted to stop the cash flow by dealing with the abuse of sex, drugs, and alcohol.
February 26, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:20 a.m. Could I pay someone to kill my girlfriend? Vanity came to rehearsal. Jesus, I was trying my best to look normal around the band, and then she shows up like that. A year ago, I would have been ashamed at her cackling, throwing those fucking Prince dance moves and hanging off my neck while I was trying to play. Her eyes were fucked. She must have been freebasing all night. I told her to shut the fuck up, and she got in my face and asked what I was going to do. What could I do? I just turned and walked out of rehearsal. Left her there with the guys in the band.
Tommy Lee. There was something real crazy about Vanity. She would just turn up at a rehearsal and jump on a road case and start dancing randomly out of nowhere. We'd be trying to rehearse, and Vanity would be doing this strange little burlesque show. When I first met her, she seemed cool, but then it all changed. Nicky and I were freebasing a little back then. Vanity was into that as well, and Nicky claimed she got him started on it. But Six is a big boy. He can't blame Vanity. It was his doing. Back then, Six was like a big spider's web, and he would bring others into his little fucking dark world. They would either A, never leave, or B, get so fucked up that they would panic, get out of there, and leave him to it.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. Nicky and I had very different tastes in music, religion, food, movies, you name it. It made for a relationship built on chaos and confusion, like two people getting stuck in an avalanche that never stopped rolling downhill. Life was full of surprises, with too many bruises and not enough band-aids. The highs were too high, and the lows were as deep as Hades, the home of the dead. Was I happy? Well, happy is all that you know it to be when you're a kid parading, masquerading, and raising yourself in this crooked, wicked world. Back then, it was like giving candy to a baby, or more like chocolate cake, all you can eat. Then the candles burn out, and you burn out, and wake up wallowing on the plateau of stupidity. I am happier today than I ever was. I am only unhappy when I am not paying attention and listening to God's voice for simple direction. The struggle is less because I quit fighting with God as much and now try to submit to his will, the Bible, faster. Life is a series of hits and misses and tests that never end. But the reward is when you win heaven just because you gave it your best try. True happiness comes when you obey the scriptures. My morals and values have greatly changed, and because of my faith in Jesus, quite often pain and suffering breed growth. I dig doing what's right. I hate pain.
February 27, 1987. Van Nuys, 10:50 p.m. Vanity left when Pete came over today. We've decided to throw a party. I'm waiting for Jason now, and Pete's gone down to Sunset to pick up some girls from the strip clubs and bring them back here, and it's never hard to persuade them. Before I was so strung out, I used to go out and pick up girls and bring them back myself. Now I'm too reclusive to do it. Every time I go out, somebody gets in my face and wants something from me. I just can't handle it. It's not just the drugs, it's the fame. It's overwhelming these days to go anywhere. We're on the cover of every magazine on the newsstand. Let us pray. 7 million bodies lying dead beneath my hands. War was such a simple game to play. Preachers do my bidding, yet blame me for their sins. Altar boys are taken in dismay. Kill and eat your neighbors. Gas the subway in Japan. I got more apocalyptic plans. February 28, 1987, Van Nuys, 6:15 a.m. Well, that was quite a night, until I brought it crashing to a halt as usual. Pete came back around 2 with 20 girls, and all hell broke loose. I was pretty drunk and ended up fucking a girl in the bathroom while another girl banged on the door. Then, when we were done, the second girl came in, got mad at me for screwing her friend, then fucked me as well. I'm pretty sure Pete fucked them both, too. What about the other 17 or 18 girls? I can't keep track. It was a cool night until about 5, when the coke came out again. I was just going to do a few lines, then suddenly I was wired and just wanted everyone out of my house. I couldn't bear them being there, so I told Pete to tell everyone to get the fuck out. I don't need anything but my drugs, my guitar, and my journal.
Tim Lutzi. Nicky once showed me his heroin den in his closet. There must have been 100 2-inch by 2-inch pieces of torn aluminum foil covered in dark stains lying on the floor. He also took me in there once and shot up in front of me. He had the rig, the spoon, needle, cotton, flame tie-off that was wickedly sick. Nicky asked me to do it as well, but it wasn't my cup of tea.
Lost lyrics. Yuppies dressed up as satanic clowns. Commit another suicide just to please the crowds. And this antifreeze is how we shoot the breeze. With this bottle and the keys, we'll drive off in our disease. Handsome dreams dressed up as a scheme, and the reason for a gun is to prey on the meek. Last year's haggard housewife scored a sedative as a lover, sits on her kitchen floor and eats from the same gun as her mother. God bless the weak. 4:15 p.m. I just had an outrageous memory from last night. Right before I broke out the blow and decided to end the party, this big redhead girl I'd never seen before dragged me in the bathroom and gave me a blowjob. She'd never said a word until she was done. Then she said, "You'll never forget me, right?" I agreed. then I'd forgotten her about 20 minutes later. I need to take it easy for a few days.
Ross Halfen. Women always liked Nicky because he had the je ne sais quoi of a rock star, but also a really innocent face like the guy next door. He'd always fuck the ugliest women, though. He'd meet an ugly girl and tell me, dude, no matter how fucked up I am, don't let me bone her. But he'd always end up going off with him. Always. He just seemed to like doing the most extreme thing possible.
March 1987. Blood was spurting all over the closet, and I was just slamming the drugs any place under my skin, praying they would take the pain away. March 1st, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. Today I checked my answer machine. I hadn't played it back for a few days. Steven Tyler had called, asking if I was okay. So weird. This guy I idolized as a kid is looking out for me as if he's my dad, which is more than my dad ever did. I left messages for Keith Richards asking if he wants to meet up and write songs together, but he never calls back. March 3rd, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:30 a.m. T-Bone came over after rehearsal. The usual routine. Chill out with a couple shots of Jack in front of MTV. Then I bring out the gear and we shoot up. Why can Tommy do drugs better than me? Why doesn't he get hooked? Tommy's the brother I never had. He has this energy and positivity I just haven't got. I get off on that. And I give him, what, maybe a darkness and edginess he doesn't have, in which in some twisted way he admires. It freaks me out that Tommy's never mentioned how I fucked up his wedding. Love him for that. When Tommy had told me a year earlier that he was to marry Heather Locklear, I replied, "Great, dude. I'm so excited to be your best man." Come to think of it, he never actually asked me to be his best man. Maybe I was just jumping the gun a little there. I was still with Nicole. We checked into the Biltmore Hotel in Santa Barbara for the wedding weekend. We had decided to try to kick heroin again. So we took just enough drugs to get us through the wedding, and after that, we were going cold turkey. And people were shocked by my appearance at the wedding. Not only had I lost a lot of weight and looked gaunt and kind of yellow, but I also was not very lucid. I kept vanishing to the bathroom, and I felt really uncomfortable because I had simply forgotten how to socialize and to be around people. When it came to the best man's toast, I had no idea what to say. Somebody told me to say, "May all your ups and downs be between the sheets." And I tried to, but I fucked it up. It all came out wrong. Heather was from a very wealthy, conservative family, and they must have been truly horrified at this junky best man swaying about at their daughter's wedding. After the wedding, Nicole and I went back to the hotel, shot up our last bit of dope, and threw away everything. We broke all the needles, and we kicked at the Biltmore, and it was horrible. I was really sick, and the weirdest thing I can remember is that there was a Little House on the Prairie marathon on TV. Every time I came to from my kick before passing out again, it was on. I still can't watch that fucking show today. It brings back that memory too clearly. Years later, I sat in an airport with a girl from the show, and that even gave me the creeps. Not her, just the thought of that damn show. Eventually, Nicole and I drove back from Santa Barbara to Van Nuys. For the first time in months, we were clean. When we got home, we scoured the place, found all our dope and needles, and put them in the garbage can. They were out in the street for 2 or 3 days waiting for the garbage man to come. Then on the third day, I started getting a second stage withdrawal. It's not as intense as the first stage, but it still hits you. Your brain tells you just to have a little. You'll be okay. So I said to Nicole, "Let's chip a little." She said I'd love to, but I don't want to get strung out again. I said, "Me neither. I can't believe we're off junk." So Nicole went out to the trash, found the dope and the dirty needles, and that was it. We were strung out again like we had never even stopped.
Tommy Lee. When Nicky showed up at my wedding, he was transparent.
He wasn't white or even gray. I thought I could see straight through him. Nicky couldn't have looked any worse if he'd been knocked down by a Mack truck. He looked fucking terrible. He was doing everything in his power to pull it together and be a part of the day, but I'll never forget how bad he looked. He was drinking everything in sight to try to stay even, but you could tell he just wanted to get away from everyone and get high. He had that look of panic in his eyes. Then as soon as the wedding was over, he was gone. I never gave him a hard time for it, but best man? It sure fucked that one up.
Midnight. I've been playing a lot of open tunings on guitar. It's interesting how I play with more rhythm. I think I'll buy a piano and see where I go musically. I need inspiration. I feel like I'm onto a different journey sometimes. Metal is boring me. I'm being drawn to Tom Waits, Ricky Lee Jones, Velvet Underground. I guess it's the heroin. I wrote a song today called Veins. Veins. I know I'm medicating. I know that you've been praying. I know that God is waiting. Something tells me he can't save me. I know that I'm procrastinating. I crumble under cravings. I know that I'm novocating. God is laughing and he won't save me. Drug under the tracks again. I lost another. It's my only friend. I miss my veins. I miss my everything. Collapsed and punctured. Have I gone insane? I miss my veins. I cannot beat this thing. One more shot, I'll be just fine again. I miss my veins. March 4th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:30 p.m. I'm finding it hard to find veins to inject into lately. My arms are fucked. It's getting harder and harder to find a good vein in my feet. Tonight I sit in my closet injecting into my neck with a shaving mirror. Weird shit on the freeway today. Pete and I are driving down the 405 in my Jeep, both in our leather pants and no shirts. Some redhead waved at us from her car, and I asked Pete if he knew her. He said no. I said I didn't either. Then she pulled alongside us and said, "Hey, Nicky, it's me. How you doing?" I tried to play along with it, but she looked furious, gave us the finger, and drove off. This city is full of fucking insane chicks. Danger. Had wild dreams, walk in the streets. Hell, we were young, never looked back. So we took our dreams, ran like hell. Lived our youth from the wishing well. Me and the boys, we made a pact to live or die, no turning back, scarred for life. March 5th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:40 a.m. I just got woken up after 1 hour's sleep. When I answered the door, some crazy woman started yelling at me and calling me an asshole. Took me a minute to recognize her as the freak who flipped us off on the freeway yesterday. I asked her what her fucking problem was. This made her go even more insane. Turns out she gave me a blowjob at my party last week and expected me to remember it. Shit, this girl doesn't know me too well. When Motley got big, we would fuck anybody and everybody, and usually did. Or rather, me, Tommy, and Vince did. Mick always danced to his own tune. But I was always bored by girls and wanted them gone as soon as I was done. Sex to me was always about conquest. Girls were a form of entertainment, nothing more, and when heroin came along, it blew them away. The girls were like a crush. It was when I met heroin and Freebase that I fell in love. Primal Scream. If you want to live life on your own terms, you got to be willing to crash and burn. March 6th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. We were in the studio today and I heard Tommy playing a really cool little piece of music on the piano in the other room. I ran in, sat down, joined him, and we wrote a gorgeous song that Barry fucking Manilow would be proud of. I have the cassette with me now and I have a brilliant idea. I'm going to write this one for Nicole. Nicole and I had finished when she came out of rehab clean in the middle of 1986, and we discovered that we had nothing in common except heroin. So, no hard feelings, you might figure, but it wasn't that simple. I was convinced that Nicole had cheated on me while I was away touring Theater of Pain. I was pretty sure that she had been fucking Jack Wagner, a pretty boy actor from General Hospital. The fact that I must have cheated on her 200 times during the same tour didn't even enter my mental equation. Jack Wagner had had a chart hit with a piece of slop called You're All I Need, and in my twisted head, it felt like the time for some serious revenge.